in Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17, still David and Goliath, but now we've reached the point where David is actually present at the battlefield. Last time we talked about his mission to go to the battlefield and the messages that we take from it. Now David is actually there. His brothers, actually he arrives at the camp, and his brothers, sorry, the recording is not, oh, I'm not recording video, sorry, I should mention that. I decided to stop doing the video uploads just because in reality, like, no one watches 1 hour long classes on YouTube, and I looked at the viewing statistics that they give you for it, and like a person will go watch it for like 30 seconds and then stop because no one watches an hour long video. And on the other hand, people who subscribe to the YouTube channel get notifications every time something is uploaded. And if you get notifications for stuff you're not interested in, then you unsubscribe. And we don't want to lose the people who subscribe to get our, you know, daily video, Divrei Torah, and that sort of thing. So I decided in the end, not recording video for it. So yes, that's correct. But the audio is still being recorded, still being posted to YU Torah. No problem. Okay. So David arrives at the camp. His brothers are at the battlefield. He goes to the battlefield, and he hears Goliath's challenge, and he responds to it. I should note that the session today is dedicated with the following donations from our Day of Giving, from Clive and Jeanette Bayala, from Diane Kadeski, and from Joey and Elisheva Fox. Diane, thank you. Okay. One other note, actually. Alina sent me a very interesting video, which is going to come up later on in the chapter. Malcolm Gladwell did a TED Talk talking about David and Goliath. He has some very interesting ideas. He gets the story wrong, but he has some very interesting ideas anyway. Meaning, an example of getting the story wrong, since it's something we've already covered, this element of his Dvar Torah, if you will, is he talks about how Goliath comes out to offer single combat to the Jews after the armies have been in a standoff for weeks. But when you actually read the text, you find that he came out in the beginning, and he came out for 40 days. So just little things like that, and then some bigger things that he says don't really fit the text, but it's great to see him do it anyway, and to see what he does with the story is very interesting, and he knows how to tell a story, that's for sure. So as it becomes relevant for what we're talking about in the chapter, I expect I will draw on it and probably share the link. If you want to look online for it, you can just probably search Malcolm Gladwell Goliath or something like that and find it. But in any case, this is the section we're in here, where David learns about the threat from Goliath, from Goliath. If you take a look in the Psukim, Perek Yitzayim Pasuk Chav Beis, chapter 17, sentence 22, is where we left off. David arrived, but the armies were already headed out to the battlefield from their camp. So Vayitosh David es hakelim me'alav al yad shomer hakelim. David left the utensils, the tools, the implements, and what we said last time, perhaps the receptacles with the food, with the person whose job was to guard those things. And he ran to the battlefield. And as I noted last time, it doesn't say he ran to his brothers. It says he ran to the battlefield. And that seems to be what really attracts him. Certainly, his older brother Eliab is going to think that that's what attracts him. He's interested in seeing the battle. He arrives and he asks how his brothers are. Sentence 23. He is speaking with them. The Ish HaBeinayim, we've described that already, literally the man in the middle. We gave a few different explanations, but the simplest explanation is he is between the two camps. This man, Goliath HaPlishti Shemo, his name is Goliath, he is the Philistine Migat, from Gat, and then you have this odd word that we noted last time. Mima'arot or Mima'arachot Plishtim. So this is a case that we call Kri Uktiv. ktiv, meaning the word is written in Hebrew as mima'arot, from the caves. However, it's pronounced mima'archot, from the camps, battlefield alignments of the Plishtim. So, when you have a kri uktiv, when you have a text that's written one way and read another, it's possible to suggest that there's a right way and there's a wrong way. For some reason, we have a tradition of writing it this way, but the real word is the way that it is pronounced. That's one way to look at it. I said that's one way to look at it. I didn't say we know anything. I see you, Ricky, and I see you, Ruth. But that's one way to look at it. And sometimes, that's the only way to look at it. In the sense that you have cases, like happen a lot in, or relatively a lot, in the Book of Ruth, in which there are simply gaps. And we know that you're supposed to read a word there, but there's no word in the text. If you were to open up a scroll, Megillat Ruth, you wouldn't see a word there. And the reader is just supposed to know, so there's nothing else there. It's just a gap. Or I'll give you another example. In the Book of Bereishit, quite a few times you find the word na'ara, meaning young girl, it seems, which should be written in Hebrew, nun, ayin, resh, hey, written nun, ayin, resh. So, for example, Rivka is described as a na'ara, and there's no hey at the end of the word. But everybody understands the word should be na'ara, female, youth, or young female. The word should not be na'ar, the word should be na'ara. So we just look at it and sort of ignore the fact that it's written a different way. However, the other way to do it is to say there is actually an extra layer of meaning. The word has meaning in the written form, and the word has meaning in the way that it is read. Great example of that is something that we saw when we learned the story of Pesel Micha back in the end of Shoftim. Do you remember the name of the Levi who became a Kohen for Pesel Micha and then eventually went to Dan? Close, right. That was his grandfather. It says in the text, Yonatan ben Gershom ben, and then the word is written, mem nun shin hei. However, the nun is above the line. And so we look at that and say, read it Menashe, read it Moshe, there are two different lessons. Or to give a better example, because that one's not kriuktiv, that's not written one way or pronounced a different way, it's actually pronounced Menashe. But an example of kriuktiv, a very dramatic one, would be from earlier in the Book of Shmuel, when we talked about I'll give the example from the Chumash, when Hashem warns the Jews that if they break their covenant, they're going to suffer in various ways. One of the ways that he says they'll suffer is with batichorim, is the way we read the word. We saw that word in the beginning of Shmuel also, but it's written ba'apolim, which is a different word. And we discussed why that is, and we discussed this at the time in the fifth parak in Shmuel. We said that there's meaning to both the way it's written and the way that it is pronounced. Here too, commentators assume that there's a meaning to the way this word is written. It's written ma'arot, it's pronounced ma'arachot. Well, if it's going to be the way that it's written, I have a problem. In other words, he is described, Goliath, again, for those who joined in just now, we're in sentence 23, Pasuk Chav Gimel. If you tell me to read it the way that it is pronounced, so that's clear. Goliath, the Philistine from Gat, came from the camps of the Philistines. He emerged from the camps of the Philistines to go stand there and threaten the Jews. However, if you read it the way it's written, you have a problem. Because then you're saying, Goliath, the Philistine from Gat, from the Philistine caves. I don't understand. Is he from the city of Gat, a developed city, one of the big five Philistine cities, at one point the central Philistine city, Or is he from the caves? So the sages looked at this and took it in different ways. The Gemara has a medrash about Arpa, which I'm not going to go into because it's certainly not the type of medrash to do at a women's shir. It's a little bit unkind about Arpa and about the conception of Goliath. But the word ma'arot, yeah, Susan, you read it in the commentary in the pink book. That's fine. Everyone can look at her face and you know exactly that I'm not reading it. But basically ma'arot can be understood as an act, the act with which she conceived Goliath, and that, hang on, Ethie, and the impropriety of what went on in it is all read into the word ma'arot. Yes, Ethie. The Shva isn't under the Resh. Remember, there are no dots in a scroll. The reason the Shva is written there is because if you read it as mi ma'archot, then you have to have a Shva under the Resh. It's to make it fit with the Kri. It's not there in the original. Yes, Susan. No.
Oh, so this is just...
Yeah, this is just what we know, because we know it. Correct. I should note, there are certain cases of dots over letters in the Chumash, in an actual Sefer Torah, but not this. No. So Radak gives me a different approach. Radak says, Ma'arot is actually a geographic or topographical term, but it doesn't mean cave. He notes that you can read Ma'ara as a reference to a plain, like P-L-A-I-N. And that it's the plain where the Plishtim camped. But Professor Keel in the Dot Mikra offers other explanations, and he says, it may not be a contradiction, saying he's from caves and from Gat, because he claims Beit Guvrin is not that far from Gat. Now, the truth is, Beit Guvrin, of course, has caves. I looked at a map. They seem pretty far east of Gat to me. Nonetheless, that's his suggestion. But then he offers what is, to me, the most intriguing idea. He says, maybe we're meant to read Mima Arot Plishtim literally. The caves of, well, not literally, as a message, but read it as caves. In other words, the caves of the Plishtim. Who lives in a cave?
It's a put down.
It's an insult, exactly. Who lives in a cave?
Animals.
Either someone who's primitive, right, animalistic, or somebody who's fearful. Do you remember the last time the Jews fought the Plishtim and we described the Jews as fleeing to the caves? So now what we're saying here in the text, Professor Keel says, is turning it around. Goliath the Philistine from Gat, who's from the caves. This time the Plishtim are the ones who are in fear, or the Plishtim are the ones who are primitive. Okay. Either way, he shows up. And he speaks the same threats and taunts that he's been speaking. And then we're told in Pasuk Chaf Dalet, sentence 24, V'chol ish Yisrael berosam es ha'ish. All those Jews out there at the battlefield, they see this guy. Vayanusu mipanav, they run away. Vayira'u me'od, and they're very afraid. Vayomer ish Yisrael. And a Jewish man said, or the Jewish men in general, said, ish does not have to be singular here. Hara isem ha ish ha ole hazeh. Did you see that guy? Ki lecharefes Yisrael ole. He came out in order to, literally, chet resh pe is like the word kherpa, shame. He came out to put the Jews to shame. Usually we use that term lecharef, like blasphemy, that kind of a term. Whoever kills this guy, the king is going to make him a very wealthy man. And he'll give him his daughter, the princess. and he will make his family chofshi in Israel. What does the word chofshi mean?
Free.
Sorry?
Free.
Free. Right. So Rashi says, free from royal demands, all the things the government is able to do, the things that a king is able to demand of you, nothing. He will be free of such demands. Radak says, based on Targum Yonatan, it means they'll make him a noble. If you remember the verse in Ecclesiastes, in Kohelet, about Shemalkech ben Chorin, to be ben Chorin, which is a term also associated with freedom, is to be somebody who is a noble. So he'll get a title. He'll become lord of such and such, that type of thing. And then you get David. Pasuk Chav Vav, sentence 26. Vayomer David el ha'anashim ha'omedim imo le'mor. David says to the men with him, Ma ye'aseh lo'ish asher yakeh ha'plishti halaz. What is going to be done for the man who strikes this Philistine? Ve'sir cherpa me'al Yisrael, removing shame from Israel. Ki mi ha'plishti ha'arel hazeh. Who is this Philistine anyway? That he puts to shame or he blasphemes against the camps of the living God.
It doesn't sound like an altruistic wish to fight him. It just simply wants to get something for him.
Yes and no, because you're going to have to explain the second half of the sentence then. The first half and the second half sound like two different speeches. Right. So before we get to that, I have a different question. I'm gonna come back to the point you're making, and that possible read. But first, I have a question for you, which is, doesn't David already know what the reward is?
Yeah, what he's already stabbed is as confusing as the second half. Yeah. He just found out.
So which is it? I don't understand. Does he know or doesn't he know? That's my problem. As I put it on the top of your sheet, 1726 versus 1725. We just told you what the reward is. Why does David not know what this is? So Abarbanel says David wasn't there. He says in 1725, right? In the previous verse, it's just describing conversations that went on. This is what people were saying before introducing David. That's Abarbanel. On the other hand, other commentators disagree. Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler, says that David is trying to start a conversation. Hey, what's the reward? You know, here I am at the battlefield. I totally fit in with everybody else. That's the way Mitzudat David reads it. Malbim, though, says something which is very important in his understanding of the rest of the chapter. He says, David is expressing shock. And specifically, and it's going to go back to what Janine was saying and towards where Ricky was talking about as well. Malbim understands that David is shocked that anyone needs a reward as an incentive. What he is saying is this, as Malbim reads it. David says to the people with him, what's going to be done for this man who strikes this Plishti and removes the shame from Israel? Meaning, why is anything going to be done to somebody who does that? Who is this Philistine coming out and blaspheming the armies of God? How dare he? Is the way that Malbim reads this. And we'll talk more about this view, but that's his way to understand this. So we've read the Psukim. We've read the passage. We have a basic understanding of David gets there, David sees Goliath, hears Goliath's threats. We understand that there is this reward, and we see David with a response which is a little bit vague. What questions come up for us as we read these psukim, these sentences? What questions should bother us here? The ones that we just read.
The 22 to 26. Well, we mentioned quite a few already.
We've mentioned some. There's more.
Who are the people that are standing with him? Wasn't everybody running away?
Well, did we say they ran away? Oh, by Anusumi Panav. That's true. Quite a few of them fled. Who knows? Maybe David's with them. I don't know. Right. It could be that they sort of retreated, but it doesn't mean that they're gone. That could be. It's a good point, though. Claudette and then Sandy. Hang on. Right. So that's an interesting question Claudette is asking. I would respond a little bit by saying, you know, we're living in a different time now. I'm not sure how formal and official it would have been 3,000 years ago. Yeah, basically, you show up, you're willing to pick up a weapon, we'll call you soldier, I suspect. But I don't know. It's an interesting question for sure. So that's something that we are going to talk about is it's going to be very clear right after this, excuse me, as we continue in the chapter, that David is deliberately planting something. He definitely is trying to get noticed. And that's something that we'll definitely see. Sandy, what were you going to say?
Yeah.
So I would note he's not too young to be conscripted. That's not the case. He's not too young to be conscripted. We know that. Hang on, Claudette. We don't know his exact age, but we know that he's 30 when he takes the throne in Hebron. And if you accept the traditional read of Shaul's reign, that it was only a couple of years. So he is somewhere in his late 20s. The reason why he isn't conscripted, we suggested, was because he has three older brothers from the family who are already there. But in terms of David standing out for his confidence, that's definitely a question. Why is David not intimidated? David's like, hey, come on, why isn't anybody fighting this guy? Like, well, David, have you seen him? Like, what do you mean, why isn't anybody fighting this guy? That's very interesting. So I saw a bunch of people unmute. I'm going to try to do it in the following order, based on the order in which I saw them unmute. I apologize, because I see five, I think. But here's the order I'd like to follow. Claudette, Linda, Ruth, Hannah, Alina. Claudette, go. Mm-hmm. Saul is busy being afraid, right? That's what we had said. So it absolutely plays up the fact that he is intimidated here. And we're going to have to come back to that because it's going to factor into the rest of the chapter as well. Linda.
I don't think that I unmuted. I don't know what happened.
Oh. Sorry. We hear you. Ergo, you unmuted.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that, rather than getting very complicated about it could just be that mistake.
Right. So the problem is that the commentators really don't look at this as an error. And it's hard to conceive of it as an error. And this is always an issue when people talk about the possibility that you're seeing scribal error. It's not as though all the texts we have were copied from a single text at some point in the transmission line where a mistake in one could have translated into a mistake in thousands. We have had cases in Jewish history, to take a more sacred sefer, talk about the Sefer Torah. We have had cases in Jewish history where individual communities had mistakes in their Torah, and the result was that copies that were made from that Torah carried on the error. But not that all of them would have the error. It's just not logical to expect that. That would be a different thing. Ruth. We are definitely demonstrating David's bravery, that's for sure. But the question is still, why was he more brave than everybody else? Where did that come from? We'll see. There's more to be said. Chana, and then Alina, and then I see more people unmuting, but I also still need to go ahead. So we're going to try to take some more comments, but please keep it as brief as possible. Right, so we're going to come back to that. Chana points out the Ruach Hashem. We are going to come back to that. Good. Alina.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, is it normal to sort of expect a type of reward? Like, David asked about a reward, and we've seen this number in the past for people who go out to the battlefield. Is this, like, a normal practice that there should be, for the warriors, some kind of, payment? I'm just wondering about that.
So we definitely have had payment for warriors. You can go all the way back to the Chumash and the war against Midian, in which they received a percentage of the profits. Chana, what were you saying? Right. And that's a case that we are going to come to, is that Kalev offers his daughter to the person who conquers Devir Kiryat Sefer. And we're going to have to talk about that story, because that's going to relate to this directly. Okay, Ora. Yeah. Even though you're right, we don't see it in the text. Shaul is very much hanging back, as was noted. The assumption is they didn't make this up, because it's real, and it in fact, he follows through on it. Leona, and then we're going to go ahead. Nope. Oh, unmuted by accident. Okay. So. So again, that was Ora's point. We don't have a direct quote from Shaul. Nonetheless, it is true within the story. So the answer is, the fact that we don't see Shaul make the proclamation just demonstrates how out of the picture he is. The fact that this is here, but we don't actually get Shaul making the proclamation. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, Diane? No, this isn't David. This is people out in general talking, going back to sentence 25. So here's what I see here. We have three questions to ask. Number one, why would Shaul think that promising his daughter made sense? Nobody talked about this yet, but I'm kind of surprised no one here asked this question. Why is it okay? You just you have no idea who's going to beat Goliath. Maybe it's going to be like another Goliath. Do you really want him as your son-in-law? Well, that's nice, but this isn't supposed to be a fairy tale. So hang on. I don't want you guys answering this question. I am putting the questions out there, and then we're going to learn it. Otherwise, we can just, promote all sorts of ideas, but never get to the text. So, number one, why is Shaul thinking that this makes sense? Number two, David sounds like he's interested in this reward, even as he also sounds like he is shocked by it. What is that about? And number three, as was asked before, why is David not intimidated when everybody else is? So first of all, let's talk about the daughter thing. So, Malbim thinks, yeah, this is totally cool. Absolutely. Take a look at source number two. He says, Masha amarnu, ki ha'ish asher yakenu yekabel osher gadol ubas hamelech. That which we've said, that the person who defeats Goliath is going to get great wealth, is going to get to marry the princess. Ze lo yake'en sachar al hatachlit, shepa'al ha'yedei pe'ulaso lichvod amo v'leilokav. He says, this isn't a reward for the result, for the fact that you have succeeded in saving the honor of the Jewish people. That's not it. It's only for striking Goliath, for the act that you perform. If you can manage to defeat such a terrible person, aside from the result, which is the benefit you've provided for everybody, you yourself are worthy of marrying the princess. Because you're clearly a mighty person, a man of substance. So, and worthy of honor and glory and wealth and all those nice things. In other words, what Malbim is saying is this. He's effectively addressing our shock that you need such a reward. And what he's saying is, divide up what somebody will be doing by defeating Goliath into two parts. One part is achieving wonderful things on behalf of the Jewish people. That's one part. You are saving the honor of the nation, the honor of God, and that's great. It's not for that that you're getting this reward. That's not what leads to this reward. However, what you're also doing is you are showing your character by the fact that you would go out against Goliath and the fact that you're actually victorious. That is what leads to getting to marry the daughter of the king, because that shows that you are worthy, that you deserve to marry the princess. You follow?
If you survive.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. If you succeed. If you don't succeed, everybody will remember you nicely. They'll make a statue somewhere. But that's exactly the point. I see you, Susan. The way Malbim reads it is, this isn't a reward for saving the honor of the Jews or getting Shaul off the hook. What this is if you show that you are such a superlative person, then you will have earned the daughter of the king. I see your hand, Susan. I see some other comments, but I want to go further because Malbim stands alone in this regard. The Gemara in Tanis very clearly does not agree. Take a look at source number 3. We learned this back in Shoftim Perek Yud Aleph when we saw the story of Yiftach, Perek Yud Aleph, Perek Yud Beis in Shoftim. And Yiftach saying, whoever I come back from the battlefield, if I win this war against Ammon, so whoever comes out of the house first, I will give to God. And then, of course, it's his daughter. So the Gemara says, Shlosha Shalu Shaloka Hogan. Three people asked inappropriately. Lishnayim Heshivuhu Kahogen. Two of them got a nice answer anyway, even though they were wrong for the way they did it. Lechad Heshivuhu Shalo Kahogen. And one, unlucky, got a bad answer. Ve'eluhain, here are the three. Eliezer Eved Avram. Right? Avram sends his servant to go get a wife for Yitzchak. Who is he supposed to find? Whom is he supposed to get for Yitzchak? Not just any woman. Who is he supposed to get?
Avram's relative,
from the family of Nahor. So he shows up at the well, and what does he look for? What does he say to God?
He asks if Hashem will show him someone who shows chesed.
Yeah, someone who's going to offer water to me and to the camels and all, right? That's the one who's supposed to marry Yitzchak. No, it's not. You may come out with a very, very fine woman who is not from the family of Nahor. And if you bring her back to marry Yitzchak, Avram is not going to be happy with you. What did you think you were doing? And yet, it all worked out. Don't worry about it. That's one. Shaul ben Kish. What, Eti?
Wasn't that the well of
Nahor? No, it was a city well. There were lots of people out there. Yeah. Then you have Shaul ben Kish. Shaul is our story, offering his daughter inappropriately because you don't know who's going to beat Goliath. Some, you know, could be another Goliath. And it ends up being David, so he's saved. I'm not sure Shaul thought so in the end, but nonetheless. And then your third one is Yiftach, and Yiftach gets burned because it's his daughter who comes out from the house. The leave aside that story for now. Those who want to know more, go back to the recordings from Shoftim. But side note, we did have one other story, and Chana mentioned it before, which is the story of Achsa, daughter of Kalev. Kalev says, whoever is able to conquer this city for me will get to marry my daughter. The Gemara here does not mention Kalev. The Medrash in which this appears, because it also appears in Brachos Rabbah, does mention Kalev, and lists him also as making an offer that is inappropriate, but God takes care of him anyway, because Dvir is conquered by Othniel ben Kenaz, who is the first Shofet. But there's a whole piece in the Gemara in Temura which says that conquering Kiryat Sefer was not a military accomplishment, but it actually referred to conquering books, conquering Torah, and it was a spiritual accomplishment. And Rashi says maybe because it's so bothered by the idea of him offering his daughter to somebody who wins a war, and therefore it's taking this other view. But in any case, I'm not going into that right now. That's just a side note. But here, Malbim thinks Shaul is doing the right thing. Shaul is saying, this guy is going to have good character. He's worthy. The Gemara doesn't think so.
It's ironic because, say, not because he stood up for God, but that's not why he deserves it, because he's strong.
I don't think that's what he's saying. He's saying, not because he succeeded in saving God's honor, so to speak. In other words, it's not a reward for the accomplishment. Rather, it's a, I'm just muting everybody by default because I just saw the note in the chat. But continue to unmute as needed. It's not that he's being rewarded because of what he achieved. He's being rewarded for his attempt and the fact that he would strike Goliath. It's not really a reward. It's a demonstration of his worth. That's the way to look at it. It's not about reward. It's sort of, if he's able to put this on his resume, that's the guy I want to have marry my daughter. That's the idea. You know, some people want a son-in-law who has a job. Some people want a son-in-law who, you know, regularly learns and participates in the community and engages in chesed. He wants a son-in-law who can beat up giants. You know, we all have our preferences, and who's to judge? So that's Malam's take. But within the Gemara's approach, the Gemara says Shaul is wrong. So the question then is, how could Shaul do this? How can you promise your daughter like this? So when we learned the story with Kalev, when we learned about that, we brought two justifications. One justification came from the Sfas Emes, the Gera Rebbe. And he said, there's a Gemara in the beginning of Sota. I see your hand, Ricky. I saw your hand also, Claudette, but I'm going to go through this first. The Gemara in Sota suggests that a person's first marriage is preordained by God. Doesn't matter who you are. A person's second marriage is based on a person's merit. If they marry a second time, you get who you deserve. I am not at all trying to put this in anybody's relationships. Please, please, please. This is not a counter at anyone. This is just the Sfas Emes quoting the Gemara. So the point, though, is that the Sfas Emes says, well, it's her first marriage. In that case, she was preordained, bashert. She was preordained to end up with him anyway. That's the Sfas Emes' answer. He's just promising his daughter to the one who God said she was going to marry anyway. And if it's a second marriage, then it's based on merit. Rav Yisrael Rosen offers a different idea. Rav Yisrael Rosen, in an article, if you take a look in source number 4, article from the journal Megadim, which I've been quoting, he says, Bishaot goraliyot, at times of lotteries, Mashlich Adam Yahavo al HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When you engage in a lottery, you're putting your burden on God. Vitzadik hagozer, but tuach shekadosh baruch hu lo yachshilenu. When the tzadik makes the decree and says, I'm going to give my daughter to whoever, you trust that Hashem is not going to make you stumble. Yesh kan nisui klape mala. It's effectively a test of God. Vatza'at habat, and offering the daughter, O haben, it's Eliezer, or Yitzchak, the son, in the case of Eliezer, misham shemein lachatz klapei shmaya, it's a sort of pressure for God. Now, that sounds like a bad thing, testing God. But it is a demonstration of emunah. So maybe that's a justification. However, Rav Bazak says, this goes back to the beginning of the story, and I sort of hinted to this before. Not on purpose, I forgot that I had this in my notes. But Rav Bazak says, remember what we said last week, the week before, who was supposed to fight Goliath? Shaul, correct. Shaul was the one who was supposed to fight Goliath. So Rav Bazak says, take a look at source number 5. Kvar hizkarnu. We have already mentioned, ki lemase Shaul hu zeh she'amor latzeis lekrav mul Goliath. Shaul was the one who was supposed to go out to battle to fight Goliath. Hapras ha'ishi me'et Shaul madgish et hanagiya ha'ishit sheyesh lo bekach shemishu yaseh b'mekomo et hamalacha. He's offering this prize, which is a personal prize. You get to marry my daughter. What do you mean? Because you took care of what I had a personal responsibility to do. That's the way that the Rav Bazak floats it. It's about saying, you did what I was supposed to do, therefore I give you a prize personally. But I will offer one more point. Again, our question here is, if you take the Gemara's view that Shaul was not supposed to do this, what's the justification or what's the reason why this happened? Why did he do it? So we've seen the view that it's justified maybe because the marriage is preordained by God based on the Gemara in Sota. Or you could say it's a declaration of faith, as Rav Rosen suggests. By the way, both that Tzvas Emes and Rav Rosen weren't talking about Shaul. They were talking about the case of Osniel ben Knaz and Kalev that we mentioned before. You could take Rav Bazak's approach that Shaul is saying, I had a job to do, you're doing it, so I give you a personal reward. But given the Gemara's criticism, I think the answer may well be, and I think Claudette was going to say this, that this is part of Shaul's decline. We have seen that Shaul is fearful. We've seen that he has lost the Ruach Hashem, that sense that God is with him and supporting him. And it could be he's desperate. And that's why he makes this offer. Claudette, you were going to say that?
Yeah, he was desperate. But then I will look at the time it was happening in, and it tells me how little value women had, you know, control of their life, because the men were offering their daughters for anything.
Yeah, I'd always like to think that he asked her first, but I'm probably naive. Well, I shouldn't say that entirely, because it's not necessarily so. I taught the Shoftim Shir the other night, and we were learning the stories of Pesal Micha and Pilagesh Begivah from the end of Shoftim. And at one point we came across a medrash which talks about who Shaul married and suggests Shaul is from Binyamin, we know. Binyamin, in the story of Pilegesh Begivah, almost dies out. And the remaining men of Binyamin get their wives by kidnapping them from a festival in Shiloh. However, this medrash on a particular pasuk, and I'm not going into the whole thing now, I'm just addressing your question, but the medrash there says that Shaul at one point says to Yonatan, you know, your mother was a rebel. All the other men got wives by taking them from that festival in Shiloh. I refused. I refused to engage in that. And so she came out and she picked me. She came looking for me. She was the rebel. So at least we have one story there in which she made the decision instead of him. The Sadie Hawkins story, if you will. Okay, I see a bunch of hands. Hang on. Hold on. I'm going to go with Ruth, Agnes, Leona, and Ricky. Go ahead, Ruth.
First of all, regarding the
So I'm not sure when you go back to the times of the Chumash that it's fair to transport, you know, the conduct of Eastern Europe, meaning the Jeanette put in the chat, you know, Rivka was asked, "Do you want to go?" Right? And she said, "I'm going to go." Sorry?
That's exactly what I was
going to
say.
Yeah. I think we have to be careful not to assume that the events of 100 years ago were necessarily the events of a few thousand years ago. I don't have any basis for saying that I know what things were like. I just think that making the assumption is not necessarily fair. Rivka certainly is being presented to us in a very different model in that story. If I wanted to be similarly anachronistic, I could point out that the Gemara itself says that you require her agreement to it, and his agreement for that matter to it, so much so that Tosfos is writing in the 12th century. Tosfos says, in our day, 12th century, we arrange marriages for minors, and it's inappropriate. He says the Gemara is against it. We do it because we live in such tumultuous times. The authors of the Tosfos are living during the Crusades. We live in such tumultuous times that if a family has the money to be able to arrange a dowry, you make your deal now, even if the children won't be ready to get married for years. But he says the Gemara is against that. The Gemara criticizes marrying off a minor. There is a clear element of volition that is supposed to happen. So I don't, you know, it would be anachronistic for me to say, aha, see that? That's what was going on in the Chumash. There are too many years separating them. But I don't think it's necessarily appropriate to make assumptions about what was going on. Okay. Yeah.
That Shaul knew that he was his line. He wasn't going to continue the kingship.
Yeah.
Is it possible he had in mind that if this guy who's going to fight Goliath is going to be brave and presumably fierce as Hashem, that he's going to be deserving of his daughter, and so in some way,
right. It's a very interesting idea. I have to admit, I had not thought of that idea at all. I think it's a very interesting idea. He's trying to find a way to pass on the monarchy. If he can't do it through his son, he'll do it through his daughter. Yeah, that's a very interesting idea. I have not seen anybody suggest it before. That is Ruth's idea. But I think it's interesting. What do you mean? Shaul doesn't know that David's been anointed. Yeah. Okay, interesting idea. So Agnes, we already hit your point now through Rivka. Leona. Right.
So, kind of the right-hand man of Shaul, and he did things that probably Shaul didn't even approve, but his orders, and they all turned out well. Where is he?
Good question. So this may be what drives the Medrash that we saw last week or the week before, when we talked about Yishai saying to David to go bring the food to the Sar HaElef, and we saw the Medrash suggest that that's actually Yehonatan. Because we were told that Yehonatan had 1,000 men in his command. So Sar HaElef, the officer of the 1,000. So what that Medrash accomplishes is not only to say, oh, Sar HaElef is Yehonatan, but it also at least positions Yehonatan at the battlefield. Now I know, oh, he is here. He's still not doing anything, which doesn't address Leona's main point, but at least I know that he's there. Yeah. Understood. It's an interesting question. The answer may be, yes, he is brave, but he's also not foolish. I don't know. It's an interesting question. Okay, I'm going to take Susan's comment and then go further because there's so much going on here. There's so much still to cover. We have 8 minutes. You know what, Susan? I'm going to ask you to hold it till 2:30 because there's. Okay. The second question that we have to address. The first one is what we talked about in terms of giving his daughter. But the second one is David looking for reward. It's really hard to accept that David is looking for reward. First of all, as we pointed out, it doesn't make sense in the sentence. In sentence 26, we find David actually say, express shock. What is this Plishti, this Philistine, whatever. It sounds like it doesn't sound like he's looking for the reward. And number two, he's been described as a wonderful person. If you go back to chapter 16, sentence 18, God is with him. He's a Gibor Chayil. He's not the type of guy who's like, hey, how much are they going to pay me if I do this? Right? I can knock off Goliath for you, but, what's it worth to you? Like, where did this come from? So that's where you get Malbim's idea, which I already have referenced. Take a look at source number 6, please. What will be done for the one who strikes that Philistine? Can it be that he's going to get another reward besides can it be that he's going to receive a reward for a deed which removes the shame from Israel? He says, the reward is the fact that you achieve this great thing. It's the deed itself that is its own reward. Because look at this Philistine. He says, the heart of everyone who is outraged for God and for his nation will gird itself. Linkom nakam mitzad tav eras hakinava nekama la'amo v'le lokav. Just because, he has such fire in these words, just because of the burning outrage and vengeance that he feels for his nation and for God. Lo mitzad asachar, he's disgusted, David. He's like, how can it be? Why is nobody acting up? And this reward isn't even a necessary thing. Right? That's the way that he looks at it. And the people respond by saying what we saw in source number 2. The people respond with what we saw in source number 2 above, which was that striking him demonstrates that you're worthy of marrying her. It's not a reward at all. That's the way that Malbim understands the response. So David is expressing disgust and shock, like, why is there a reward? And the people are answering him by saying that's not what it is. It's not about a reward. And if you look in sentence 27, you see it. Vayomer lo ha'am kadavar hazeh le'mor. The nation said like this, saying, Ko ye'aseh la'ish asher yakenu. So will be done for the man who strikes him, meaning it's just for striking him, for it shows about you, separate from the fact that you have done this for God. But now we come to our last question, and we do it with 5 minutes to go, which is, why isn't David intimidated? Who does David remind you of here? Think of other figures in Tanakh. Who does David remind you of?
Shimshon.
Shimshon, good. Definitely reminiscent of Shimshon. Shimshon is always, always, I see you, Leona, shaking your head and shaking your hand, but think about it. Shimshon is always sure that Hashem is going to take care of him, and he is always going to succeed, no matter what he has done wrong, no matter how many Plishti women he's involved with. Shimshon is always confident that it's going to work out. That's a good one. Who else? Ora. Sorry?
Yeshua and Kalev?
Do you see them as being like...
They saw that there were giants who lived there based on the size of the fruit or whatever, and they were still,
Right, they're still insisting we can do this. Okay, I hear it. I feel like it's we don't get enough of their personality, but I definitely see it in their sense that, yes, the Jews can press forward. Who else?
Joseph,
definitely a Yosef personality here in David. We're continuing that association. Yosef, yep, God is with me. God's taking care of it. God sent me here. What else? Who else?
If we take about a woman, we can take about Deborah.
Deborah, very good example. The way she pushes Barak. I was thinking of a different woman. I was thinking about Hannah.
Yes.
I was thinking about Hannah and the way that she approaches Hashem and she demands a child. But there's one other person. There's one from this week's parsha. Abraham goes to war against the kings completely fearlessly. But who else?
What about Shaul?
You think so? Early Shaul. Early Shaul, the first Shaul, so to speak. Right. Early Shaul, fair. Who else?
How about Yonatan?
Thank you. This is Yehonatan. This is the trait that we associate with Yehonatan. He killed the Plishti officer to start a war, uninvited. He launched a raid only with his armor bearer when everybody else was terrified. He said, yeah, God's on our side. Look, we're going to ask them, do we come up, do we come down, right? It is so Yehonatan. Think about that as we go forward and we find that Yehonatan and David have such a strong bond with each other. They're the same person. So that, in many ways, we have to talk more about it, but you're definitely seeing an association. And I think where it comes from is the trait of Vashem Imo, that God is with him, which we said back in 16:18, and it's going to come back again in this chapter. A trait which, by the way, we also have with Yosef. There's somebody who listens to these classes online and just emailed me last night making that point. That Yosef also, that Hashem was with him, and everything he did succeeded. He has this Ruach Hashem, the Spirit of God, which Shaul has lost, and he has gained, and it gives him this remarkable confidence. Now, there's more and more step to this, which we'll have to start with next time, which is, I think, David also sees his destiny playing out here. And that's something that's going to bring us back to, again, Yosef as well, but that's something that we'll have to start with, God willing, next time. So what we accomplished this time was we saw David arrive there, we saw the offer that Shaul made, we did an analysis of what this giving the daughter thing is. Malbim, he's right for doing it. The Gemara, no, he's not. We saw the justifications for why Shaul did it, or the explanations for why Shaul did it. David, it seems, is not looking for reward as much as he's expressing disgust for it, and he has that confidence that we associate with some of the greatest figures in Tanakh, that Hashem is going to help him, and he's going to express it as Hashem is going to make this succeed, and he's going to be able to knock off Goliath, which, of course, you know, in the end happens. Much more to say. And I apologize for having to tell some people just gotta wait, but it's the way it is if we want to cover any ground. But now, for those who can stay on, I'll take a couple of other questions and comments, starting with Susan from what you wanted to say.
All right.
Okay. Susan, you're muted.